Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. This is your host, Andrew Keel, and we have an awesome episode today. We're going to continue our risk series, and we're going to talk about infill and why value-add mobile home park projects with lots of infill have more risk, you know, for passive investors or LPs looking to invest in these projects. And I'm going to go through, you know, a few of those reasons. And, you know, infill on, you know, looking at it from the outside in is like a no-brainer, right? So there's vacant lots, you're buying a park, say it's 100 lots, and there's 70 occupied, you're going to bring in 30 homes, fill the vacancy, the revenue will go up, the income should go up, and it should be a no-brainer. Well, value-add infill projects are notorious for being just a ton of work. And we're going to go into the specifics of you know, why that leads to more risk. Number one is going to be budgeting. You know, it's really, really, really tough to know exactly what it will cost until you're in the trenches doing it, right? In due diligence, you can call contractors, you can get quotes on, you know, hooking up the plumbing, hooking up the electrical, things like that. And that's really a ballpark that they're giving you, right? They're not going to go to the property typically and like walk out the amount of, you know, wire it's going to need and all of that. So you're kind of budgeting it, and you obviously want to have like a miscellaneous fund so you have additional monies available to allocate here as needed. But again, when you're looking at a pro forma, it's not a hard and fast, this is exactly what this is going to cost, right? Like look at COVID, all the material costs like went up by 30% on everything because of all the issues with transport and things like that. So just know going in that if you're looking at a pro forma and there's a lot of infill on there and there's not like a slush fund and there's not like a, you know, extra capital available just in case fund, it could be tough. It could be tough if things don't go exactly as planned. Also, you know, when you're doing this the first time or the second time, you know, there's going to be mistakes. You know, myself included have made many mistakes, and I'm going to go through a couple of those. But mistakes for those without experience is super common, right? Number one, not raising enough money. Guilty. I did this on one of my first deals where we didn't raise enough money, and it put us in a bad spot where we had to slow down the infill and slow down what we had projected on our pro forma. So that's one. You got to raise enough money. Hiring the wrong contractor is another one, right? Like, you know, if they're not licensed to do the work, you know, you can't just hire any installer. It has to be a licensed installer to get your permits approved and get your certificate of occupancy. So that's an issue. Truck drivers. This is another big thing that unless you've been in it, you wouldn't realize, but a lot of truck drivers can't cross state lines when transporting a mobile home. So what they'll have to do is they'll bring it to the state line and then, you know, drop the home off, and another transporter will come and hook it up and drive it the rest of the way if it has to cross state lines. So like just being aware that that's a thing, and there's an additional cost, you know, for not just this transporter, but for the other one as well, is super important. And then certain states require HUD inspectors. You know, these are not your local building department inspectors. These are HUD, you know, inspectors that is like the, you know, at the federal level that will come in and inspect, you know, your new homes that have been installed. So just due diligence is so, so important to know and to really just know who to call, right? So you call your local inspector, he may not know that there's a HUD inspector going to be required if you bring in new mobile homes, because this may be the only mobile home park in town. And they, you know, it hasn't sold in 30 years and they haven't brought in any homes in a long time, you know, since he got the job, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. So he's never dealt with this before. So he may not be able to direct you to all the people that are involved. So that's where contacting your state manufactured housing association and other experienced operators that are in the vicinity is a great tool, you know, on the front end in due diligence. But yeah, you need to fully understand the process, especially if this is your first mobile home park. You know, I think I'm talking today to those people that are looking at investing passively in a mobile home park with an operator that's new, right? There's a lot of new operators in the space, and this may be their first deal. And guess what? They need, you know, they need capital to put deals together. I needed capital on my first deal, But I feel like I got lucky, you know, to be honest, on some of these mistakes. I had the wind at my back. Interest rates were low. The last 10 years, obviously, with real estate prices have just been, you know, going up. So we had some, we had some mistakes that we were able to work through. But just, you know, I'm going to go through a couple of those mistakes, but just know that when you're investing with a new operator, things can go wrong, right? And that adds risk. So let's dive in here. Let me see what I got in my notes here. So concrete costs. So brand new homes, we bought five mobile home parks up in Illinois. Geez, it's been about 5-6 years ago. And we were planning on bringing in used homes and raised money to do so. And then we realized, oh man, we can't find that many used homes. We need to bring in some new ones. So we pivoted to new homes. And this was like my third or fourth, you know, we had some parks, but not as big of an infill project as this one was. And this was in the state of Illinois, which is, you know, has more regulations than some other states, and it's a HUD state. So we're bringing in these new homes. We quoted out for like the concrete work and the site prep work, like $5,000 per lot, which was not enough because we needed to install piers, concrete piers that go down below the frost line, and they have to be 24 inches in diameter and go down below the frost line. And that's where they will set the blocks on to block level tie down the home. So we didn't raise enough money. We came in and we needed to not only get the concrete installed, but we had to pull up the concrete that was there. They didn't allow us to use the pads that were there previously because there was cracks in them and things like that. So we had to pull that out. Then we had to install the new concrete. Then we had to mound, you know, underneath the home so that water wouldn't sit underneath of the homes. And we went over budget. So that's why, luckily, we had a miscellaneous budget on that deal. But that was, you know, that could have been a very costly mistake. We were infilling like 43 homes in that group of communities. So that's a big one. Another one, one of my first parks that I bought myself with no investors, we bought some brand new homes. I think we bought 8 of them. They bring them in. I'm there. I'm in the park. I'm ready to receive these homes. But, you know, newbie Andrew didn't know what he was doing. And the truck drivers are like, hey, I got to go back and get another haul today. Where am I putting these homes? And there was some cars in front of the vacant lots where these homes were going because I didn't notify the neighbors, you know, enough ahead of time to move these vehicles. So they couldn't get into the vacant lots. So they had to leave the homes in the middle of the road, not in the middle of the road, but like on the side of the road, you know, up against the side in front of some other homes. And they left. And I was like, wait a minute, like, I need you to get these on the lot. Can you just wait for a little bit and I'll try to get this car moved? He's like, no, dude, I got to get back. I have another trip I have to get through today. So literally he left them on the road, had to find another transporter to come. And again, this was time, right? He wasn't able to come the next day. It took a couple weeks to get this other transporter back out there to get the homes and spot them on the lot, meaning like you have to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth to get it in the exact spot where it will sit on the blocks, which takes time. And it ended up costing me like another $1,000 or $2,000 to have this separate truck driver come and spot all these homes on the lots. So that's another thing that like I didn't budget for, you know, and luckily it wasn't like $10,000, but still, you know, it was a first time investor that was figuring it out as I went along. So that was in Deer Run. Next issue is utility hookups, add more complexity. You know, that's a risk. And every municipality, every utility company may have different requirements. One park we bought in Covington, Tennessee, is called the Smithville Mobile Home Community. We bought it. It had 61 lots. And basically, we were going to infill 8 homes, 8 all brand new homes. We bring the homes in, block level, tie down, get them set. I'm thinking we're golden here, right? We're hooking up the utilities. And then all of a sudden, these new homes, which have, you know, a 200 amp panel, are having brownouts, where basically like the power was shorting out like on a consistent basis for the people that were living there. So we got the power company out there and said, hey, what's going on? And little did we know, right? We did an electrical inspection on the park and we walked through with an electrician. He showed us all the pedestals and, you know, said, hey, you need to get some more conduit here to cover up these lines, but, you know, everything looks mostly good. You know, we'll just get these little items fixed for you. That's all the, you know, and he basically said everything looked great. The power company engineer comes out and he says, yeah, you're having brownouts because you have one transformer feeding 25 homes. And one transformer is only supposed to feed like 5 or 6 mobile homes. And the main line was it was like lower voltage, because older homes had, they weren't 200 amp panels back then. They were lower on these older homes. So not only did we bring in these 200 amp panel, brand new all electric homes, but it's daisy chained and there's one transformer feeding all of it. So long story short, we said, okay, so, you know, typically the power company pays for this, right? They said, no, sorry, you're going to have to pay to get six more transformers installed in this park. And it's going to cost you anywhere from $60,000 to $120,000. So couldn't even give us a definite amount on what the budget was going to be. So that's another area there where, you know, if you don't look into that up front, you don't talk to the engineer up front to understand what's coming in terms of, you know, utility infrastructure and what the main line is, you know, feeding your pedestals, it's an expensive mistake, you know? So I think that's another reason why, you know, a new first-time investor may not be looking into all those things. Another one, buying in northern states where it gets cold, the depth of the water lines and the sewer lines can make installing or repairing, you know, way more expensive, right? We own a park in Crookston, Minnesota, which is just outside of Grand Forks. And literally the water lines are 10 foot down underground, 10 foot down. So anytime we have a water leak or a riser that, like, apparently the ground shifts when it thaws and, you know, when it gets cold, then it thaws out. So the ground will shift and the water line will, like, come off, you know, in 10 foot down in the ground, the water riser will come off. So we got to pay like $3,000 or $4,000 to have someone go out there, excavate, pull it all up. And then, oh yeah, you got to, like, you know, grade the area after they've dug up all this dirt and messed up your, you know, your nice facade. So another thing you need to, you know, be aware of in northern states is there's going to be additional costs for heat tape and insulation and, you know, getting those little insulation boxes that go around your water meters when you submeter the homes. So there's just additional costs, you know, for that type of stuff that, again, if this is your first park, you got a lot of, you're wearing a lot of hats and you may not get to that. Another thing with infill, small but important, you know, something that we learned on is your steps, right? It's like, okay, we can pay someone $600. They'll build us a, you know, 4x4 platform with some steps that go up to each door, you know, two per home. Well, you also got to remember, you know, if the ground is not level, those steps are not going to be level, and they won't be able to open their door if the steps come up and are, you know, kittywampus. So basically we had to install, you know, a little platform or like a foundation of concrete and then put the steps on top of that so that the steps are always level. And again, when you infill, the steps may work fine. But then as the ground shifts and it thaws and it gets cold again and it thaws and gets cold again, that could be an issue and people won't be able to open their door. That's a huge fire safety issue if they can't open their door because the steps have pivoted up and now they're blocking the door. So just the littlest things that you don't think about until you've been through it, right? And then you know, we went through this. The tenant was telling us, hey, my steps are all wampus because the ground has shifted and I can't even open my rear door. So I had to go out there and it was the foundation. And so we had to install some concrete under those steps, which again is additional expense. Skirting is a big piece with infill. You know, skirting a home, you know, used to cost, you know, $500 in labor and $500 for the material, and you can get it done for $1,000. Not anymore. You know, with COVID and everything, the pricing went up for the vinyl skirting. And then also what we found is if you go cheap on with the vinyl skirting and you don't get like the landscaping timbers that go behind the skirting, that go underneath the home, that give it a little bit more stability, then your skirting is going to be, you know, blowing off with the wind and you'll have it blown down and it'll just look really bad. So, you know, it's worth like little things, right? Like having the foundation, having the skirting on top of, you know, either the concrete or having like a landscaping timber behind the skirting underneath the home. Another thing that helped make the park look better long-term so that when you refi or sell, you know, you're getting the most bang for your buck because the park looks good and everybody's skirting's not blown in under their home. And then, you know, that leads to other issues, right? There's metal skirting, which is like more durable and it insulates under the home better than the vinyl stuff. Also, when you're talking about underneath the home, the underbelly and the insulation under there, you know, if we're next up, we're going to talk about like used homes versus new homes, right? So if you're looking at a used home, and this is something from mistakes, right? We would buy used homes and we would never look under the home, you know, didn't need to walk through the home. Everything looked nice. We bought the home, got the title. And the transporter calls us and says, hey, man, I can't move this home. There's no underbelly. There's no like 6 mil plastic under the home, which like helps insulate the home. So, you know, they're going to have super high electric and heating costs. And then also, you know, there's no insulation underneath the subflooring. And, you know, so it's super cold. And then also like the transporter's like, hey, I can't move the home because it's so rotted out under here that, you know, the home's going to fall apart. So there's those issues that could come up that add additional risk. So yeah, going into my notes here, used versus new, you know, used homes require good rehabbers, you know, and so there's more risk when you're having to deal with these rehabbers, you know, because you can't just go hire a general contractor to typically renovate a mobile home. You're going to get more of a chuck in a truck type of handyman that's going to be, you know, able to do this type of job. And it's hard to manage remotely, especially if you're not right down the street from this mobile home park. It's going to be tough to manage those types of projects remotely from our experience. And you can easily, you know, get above your budget. And then next thing you know, you went down the path, the handyman goes rogue, you're $10,000 into the rehab, he demoed stuff, and now it's going to cost more to get it back to what it should be. And you got to hire a new contractor and he wants 15 grand. And now you're 25 grand into the home, you know, to rehab it, plus your set costs, plus the home costs. And it's like, geez, should you have just gotten a brand new home at that point, you know, which would kind of help with the appeal of the park and so forth. So that's an ongoing debate that we have with every home that needs a major rehab is, hey, should we demo it and bring in a new home? Or is this salvageable? And is it going to be a good home, right? Or is the home going to stay warm? Is the underbelly there? Is the water lines, utilities, you know, the hot water tank, the furnace, all of that kind of stuff you got to look at up front when you're doing infill with used homes specifically. And then with new homes. So new homes typically require that you meet HUD standards in most states, you know, not every state or HUD states, but like Illinois and Michigan, where we own a lot, are HUD states. And, you know, again, there's a HUD inspector, you know, there's the local inspectors as well, but you need to meet with both the HUD inspector and the local inspectors to fully understand all of this and, you know, the concrete work and what's needed with the new homes. But there is more regulation and more requirements for new homes than there is typically with used homes. So just knowing that and knowing, you know, for your budgeting purposes to be aware is important. We own a park in Norfolk, Nebraska, and this building inspector is very strict. You know, they have a code, and basically he just is not a fan of mobile home parks, right? Like the park is in a very, you know, dense urban area. I mean, it's Norfolk, Nebraska, but it's in a part of town that kind of makes it like a more of a subdivision area. And he just doesn't want it there. It kind of feels like he doesn't want it there in that part of town. It doesn't, you know, it's not like it's in the outskirts. It's right in town there. So he makes it really, really hard for us to infill, to the extent that any used home we want to bring in, he needs to go drive out. We need to pay him to go in the city to have him go drive out and look at the home and approve it first. And he's never approved a used home that we've sent him. So then it's like, oh, wow. So the plan was to go used homes. Now we're pivoting to brand new homes. And then with the new homes that are coming out of the factory, he has additional requests and requirements on those. Meaning like if the smoke, like one is a little issues, like if the smoke detectors aren't hardwired in, he's going to require that and like have you redo all of that. It's a unique scenario, but some cities you just need to know are going to have more requirements and you need a bigger budget if you're going to have to be, you know, infilling in those markets because there may be additional things required that you don't even know, but this guy, just to kind of make it hard on you, can add that in and say, oh, well, you need this. You need to have more GFIs in the home than the way it came from the manufacturer. And then you have to do that. Otherwise, he won't give you the certificate of occupancy. So another piece on the used homes, it's very hard to find them. You know, in some markets like, you know, Austin, Texas and Dallas, Texas, it's very hard to find a used home anywhere. Not that it's impossible, but like it's very, very tough to find them within, you know, a normal budget, which we typically raise, I think, 25 or 30,000 to bring in a used home and get it, you know, ready to go. But in some markets, that's just unrealistic and it's not going to be possible, especially on the West Coast. So harder to find, can take more time. And if you have a pro forma you're sticking to, you know, it may make sense to go with new homes because it's more predictable. Another big issue that's not talked about enough is matching the size of the home with the size of the lot and the required setbacks. Setbacks are like the distance from the road it has to be back, the distance from homes. It can't be just butting up to another home in the back. There has to be a distance between the back of the home and the other home on the other side. And then the homes on either side. You know, there needs to be a requirement there. And every city can have different requirements. It's not just like a standard, you know, code. And since these parks, a lot of them were built, you know, 50 plus years ago, they're grandfathered in to the setback requirements of when they were built. And so that adds other complexities because a lot of the homes back in the, you know, 60s and 70s were like 12 foot wide. So they were, and the setback requirements were very crunched on top of each other. They'd allow 12 foot wide homes with maybe 5 foot in between, and you can just stack them in some of these urban areas. Well, now the standard mobile home is 14 foot wide, and a lot of them are 16 foot wide homes. So that if you're trying to bring those in, you may lose lots. And you thought you were going to be able to buy this 80 lot park and there's 30 vacant lots and you're going to put 30 homes on those. But with the new homes, the setback requirements and so forth, you may lose some lots, right? If there's lots right next to each other, you may need to put one home between two lots to be able to meet those requirements since you're bringing in brand new homes instead of homes that meet, you know, the exact size of when they built the park, because it's really hard to find those, you know, 12 foot by 48 foot long mobile homes that were, you know, manufactured, you know, 50, 60 years ago. So just things to be aware of. Again, it adds more risk because you have all these factors that you need to worry about. And oh yeah, you're still needing to property manage the property. You're still needing to keep track of your water sewer recapture. You're still needing to, you know, work with tenant relations and make sure violations are getting handed out. So it's a whole thing. Infill is. It's not like a bolt-on. It's not just like an easy bolt-on to a mobile home park operation. So in conclusion here, I'll get through my notes. We're almost done. There's a lot to it. It's not a walk in the park. If you're a new mobile home park investor and you don't have a big team to assist you, like, you know, at this point now, since we have some scale, we're able to have an infill person. We're able to have specific project managers that can help with, you know, with the infill process. But when it's just you, you know, back when I had my first five parks, it was just me. I was opening the mail. I was talking and taking tenant calls. I was trying to, you know, hire and fire on-site managers. I was collecting rent and making collections calls. So when it's a new investor, you just need to be aware that, you know, there's likely more risk because they haven't done infill before. And they're going to be wearing a lot of hats. So an infill requires them to wear a lot more. So really, really important. So be careful on these projects, as the numbers typically look good on infill value add mobile home park deals on the spreadsheet, right? On the spreadsheet, the returns look great and it seems pretty straightforward. There's 100 lots, there's only 80 occupied, just got to bring in 20 homes. But at what cost, right? And what's that going to look like? And execution is, you know, a whole nother situation. You know, that there is an execution risk here that needs to be talked about. So we've actually bought three mobile home parks now from operators that ran out of money and they planned on infilling and ran out of their budget. And then they were, you know, the whole project came to a halt because they were just using cash flow to like try to, you know, finish out some of the infill on the homes they brought in and getting them installed and so forth. So there was homes literally just sitting there that couldn't be occupied because they hadn't been been installed properly. They didn't have steps. They didn't have skirting. And they were, you know, likely paying a mortgage on those homes to have them. And then they decided to sell. So, it's that kind of situation that could happen. And just being aware of that like, hey, there's execution risk here. If they run out of money, you know, and now they're using cash flow to infill, you know, you could be in a really tough spot as an operator and as an LP with no control. So the strategy of infill takes a long time typically. And it can leave you cash poor, especially if you're trying to like use the cash flow to like reinvest into the property, which could present another risk for LPs if the GP themselves run out of money. You know, I think that's another point that can be talked about is we have had, I think three or four projects where we didn't raise enough money and the GPs, like myself and my other partner, actually put money into the project to help finish the project and get to the refi point, you know, faster. And if you're a first time mobile home park buyer, when I was buying my first park, I didn't have any more money, right? I didn't have that ability to put that extra cash in there. And, you know, another issue is with the lenders. you know, they're going to be checking on the GP that's signing recourse on the loan. They're going to be requiring at least annually that you send in your personal financials. So along with proof of your liquidity and so forth. So, you know, when it was my first deal, luckily I partnered with someone that had, you know, a very big balance sheet and had the liquidity requirements. But when it was my first deal, right, like I had to get crafty to get that deal done, but I didn't have a ton of money myself. And most first-time GPs don't. So if they don't have that money to put into the project, that's one issue. If they don't have the money and the liquidity to show on their annual, you know, financial reporting to the bank, in the loan docs, it likely states that that lender can call that loan due. Like, think of that. And I've heard horror stories about this. I was in a self-storage mastermind a couple of years ago, and the head guy, Scott Myers, he had loans called due during like the great financial crisis where the properties were performing. They were making their debt payments and everything, but they, like, the bank sold the loan to another bank that decided, hey, we don't want to be in the self-storage business. So let's hire some attorneys to go through these loan docs and find a covenant that would allow us to call this loan due so that they have to, like, you know, refinance it or sell it so we can get this off our balance sheet. Like, that is scary to me, you know, and not that we're in that type of situation now with the economy, but that's just knowing that that has happened in the past. And if an operator doesn't have the right liquidity, that the loan could be called due, it can put, you know, your capital at jeopardy. It can put the deal at risk, and it's scary. So yeah, we've made mistakes ourselves. Luckily, you know, we had the wind at our back. Again, I'm not oblivious to the fact that low interest rates covered up a lot of stuff. And again, we've blown budgets ourselves, and thankfully we were able to put that cash in, but without needing like a capital call from investors. But we've also had other deals where I think my fourth and fifth deal, we needed to call capital. I only had one investor at that time that was helping. But again, having to do capital calls, no LP likes to hear that they need to influx capital into a deal because you ran out of money, right? So that's just, you know, another issue with infill is that, you know, could be more likely depending on, you know, the operator in the initial budget. So be safe out there. I highly recommend investing with experienced mobile home park operators that have a proven track record of completing infill if you go for these type of projects. So I would request, you know, if I was you, I would request that you try to hear about other projects they've done and ask for, you know, some proof on some projects that they've done infill and ask how those went, you know, what hurdles did they face and so forth. Anyways, thank you all so much for listening. I appreciate you all. If you got any value out of this, it would mean the world to me if you could leave us a review. Thank you again for listening and have a great day.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.